Hello and welcome to the Why Divorce Radio Show, a project dedicated to helping men and women get through one of the toughest experiences of their lives and find their way to health, happiness, and wholeness. I'm Hope Katz Gibbs, creator of the Why Divorce Project and your host. Hello and welcome to the Why Divorce podcast show on the Incandescent Radio Network. I'm Hope Katz Gibbs, your host and the author of Why Divorce, 5 Reasons to Leave. Today, I am really honored to be talking with Northern Virginia-based divorce attorney Rachel L. Virk, who is going to share her decades of experiences and the lessons she teaches in her incredibly helpful book, The 4 Ways of Divorce: Litigation, Negotiation, Collaboration, and Mediation. So welcome to the show, Rachel.
Well, thank you, Hope. I'm so happy to be here to talk about this important topic that impacts so many people.
Absolutely, it does, me included. So before we get started, let me share some of Rachel's credentials with our audience. So Rachel has been practicing divorce law since 1989. She is certified as a mediator by the Virginia Supreme Court at the circuit court family level and is a trained collaborative law practitioner. In 2018, she was recognized as a top 10 family law attorney for Virginia by Attorney and Practice magazine. Also last year, her firm was recognized as one of the 10 best law firms by the American Institute of Family Law Attorneys. And in 2017, she was voted the number one attorney in Loudoun County by its annual favorites poll. And these are super impressive accolades, and there are so many more. But what impressed me was that when I spoke at the January 10th, 2019 Sterling Women Luncheon in Loudoun County, I was talking about my book, Why Divorce, 5 Reasons to Leave, and Rachel came up and handed me her 200-page guidebook that she had penned, These 4 Ways of Divorce. I was really, really impressed and couldn't wait to read it. And as I did, I just was smiling and grinning as I was leafing through the pages. This woman so very much knows her stuff. It's truly a must-read for everyone going through a divorce or thinking about going through a divorce.
If I can just stop you for one moment, and I just want to reminisce about how we met at Sterling Women and, you know, your truly amazing women website and the work that you're doing with Incandescent and everything. I know that Christina Barueri was one of the amazing women that you interviewed, and I also had the privilege of speaking to the Sterling Women group about overcoming hardship. And divorce can be one of those hardships. And I just want to give a shout out to you because your presentation was just so amazing as you talked about the 5 reasons to leave and, you know, your trilogy of why divorce, why marry, why remarry. And I just want to say I thoroughly enjoyed your presentation. And I also listened to your interview of Christina Barueri, and I thought that you did an amazing job, and she is an amazing woman.
Yes, truly. Well, thank you very much for that. I really appreciate it. Christina and I have been friends since like 2001. And it's amazing to watch all of us go through, you know, the trials and tribulations, but also stand together with these successes. And Incandescent Women magazine, which goes live next week, I'm honored to put you in there and talk about this project, this Why Divorce project, because as women, you know, this obviously impacts a ridiculously large number. And the 5 reasons, abuse, adultery, addiction, you know, as I say, these are like definitely reasons you're being harmed, you have to go. And then abandonment and angst, the other two are a lot muddier. So I think, you know, in your book, the reason that it resonated so much with me was because I felt like your advice was spot on. You were saying what I'm saying, which is what so many women are feeling. So I can't wait to share with our audience all the insights that you have. But let me start by reading from chapter 1 so that people really can get a taste of your writing and your thoughtfulness. Chapter 1 is entitled, I'm Heading for a Divorce. What Should I Do? Where Do I Start? And you write, you want out. You no longer love or need your spouse. The kids are older and you are now earning a living wage. You are tired of your spouse's drinking, untreated mental instability, abusiveness, or emotional problems manifested in part by destructive spending habits or other addictions. Or your spouse has informed you that he or she wants a divorce or no longer loves you. You find the cell phone records, emails, credit card receipts, hotel records, or card to your spouse from his paramour, and you just decide that your spouse is unable to make you feel loved, fulfilled, and happy. There may be someone else out there who can. You don't want to feel empty and sad all the time anymore. Or yet another option is you finally found your soulmate and it's not your spouse. So now what? So those are definitely, you know, three case studies that are relevant, like every 20 seconds that's happening to somebody. So let's get into it, the four ways of divorce. So question number one is, what should you do if you are the one who wants out?
Well, Hope, the thing that's important about that question is you have to look at whether you're leaving for some of the reasons that you state, such as your spouse's adultery, addiction, abuse, or other negative dysfunction. But in your writings about the five reasons to leave, when you talk about adultery, addiction, and abuse, you seem to state that it's your partner who might be harming you. But, you know, it could be your adultery, addiction, or abuse. And the angst could be something that your partner is struggling with or something you are struggling with. So that's the thing about divorce. And, you know, your fifth reason, I'm setting a bad example for my kids. You know, I think what you're saying there is they're watching what an unhappy, dysfunctional marriage is all about, what perhaps an abusive marriage is all about. So we need to think about, is the reason for the divorce coming from one person, both people? Is it that the other person is doing something dysfunctional or you are doing something dysfunctional? There are so many different ways of looking at this. There are perhaps, quote, good reasons to end a marriage and you want out, and maybe there aren't, if somebody were going to be judgmental, not such good reasons. You know, if you just want to go start a new life with a new person in another country and abandon your kids, that may not be a good reason. If you're no longer in love with your spouse, but perhaps you found someone else you'd rather be with, I don't know. Is that a good reason? Is that not a good reason? These are very hard questions. So in terms of what you should do, I have to pick one instance or two to start with, because you can't lump everything together is my point here. So if you're the one who wants out, you may want out because your spouse is abusing you or your spouse is not addressing a mental health or a substance abuse issue. So then the right thing to do is to say, this issue is fatal to our marriage, and you need to decide, first of all, whether that issue can be resolved. I mean, I do have people come to me who say, you know, I just found out my spouse is having an affair, or my spouse is not medicating his or her bipolar disorder, and I don't know whether I should leave or not. I want to stand by my spouse. And just picking one example, such as someone who tells me their spouse is struggling with substance abuse, but they still love their spouse, but the spouse may not want to address the substance abuse or the alcohol abuse. We have to decide, well, do you want to spend the rest of your life with this person, or what you want this person to be? Are you in love with what they could be, what they should be, what you want them to be, but not what they are? Or could you assist your spouse in that road to recovery? And there are some people who actually do want to help their spouse address their mental health or substance abuse issues. But if they will not within a reasonable time frame, then someone has to take a good look at themselves and think about whether what they're doing is enabling bad behavior, or if they're just codependent and in a relationship that brings them more pain than joy, and then it's a whole nother analysis. Do you see what I'm saying?
Unbelievably so. And I talk about that in the introduction to the book, which is my story, you know, 108 first dates and one perfect lover, because I knew 10 years into my marriage that things were kind of not exactly as I hoped they would be. Would they ever? My kids were little and our lives were so interlocked and intertwined, as most married couples are, that I knew all four of us would break. So, you know, then you start unpacking it. I kept, for the next decade, kept asking myself that question. So what are the damn good reasons to leave? And you articulated them just now. It is so complicated. You want to stand by that person. And it most definitely often is you too in some way. And, you know, that's the most complicated part of it to me, because you kind of get wrapped around the cactus.
Right. I think the focus should be, do you want to spend the rest of your life with this person the way they currently are? And if the answer is no, but I want to spend my life with what they could be, should be, used to be, what I want them to be, then it's a matter of saying, okay, what, if any, steps will the two of you together or that person take within what reasonable time period to address those issues. Let's set a time period. But, you know, sometimes somebody just wants out because they're no longer happy. They feel that they could be happier with someone else. And that's a matter of letting the other person know, honestly, I don't want to spend the rest of my life with you. I want us to separate and divorce. And some people feel that it's nicer for them to break that news very gradually and slowly to the other person, but sometimes that does them a disservice because they're holding on to hope. You know, if somebody wants out and they're being vague with, you know, I think we should separate, you know, I don't feel like we're where we should be, I'm not really happy. What the person who might not want the marriage to end starts to hear is, well, maybe you won't divorce me, or maybe if we can fix this, or I can fix that, or we can go to marriage counseling. But if one person has already made up their mind that they're out of there, it's really not fair to the person they're leaving to give them hope, because, you know, then they get their hopes up, they're on that emotional roller coaster, and they can't plan, and they can't move forward.
I know so many friends who are in that situation as we speak, and, you know, it's really hard to take this step into the abyss, because you don't really know what's going to happen on the other side. And in all my thinking about this and talking to people, what keeps coming to me is the time to do that is when you feel like you're trapped in a box and there's no air left and you've tried everything you can and you just, it's almost, it's a survival step. I talked to several women who are abused, and, you know, that's the one category, the abuse piece, that I'm looking forward to people sharing their stories, because those are hurtful, whether they're the abuser or the abused. And this one woman was telling me how, you know, she said, all right, these are the five things I will not allow. And then she allows one of them. And then, like, the walls keep closing in because she's so petrified to leave. And so she finally says, so when will I leave? You know, when he's holding a gun to my child's head, you know, such a catastrophe. But I think people get themselves into situations where they feel like they can't be on their own, or, you know, it's so complicated. And I think the divorce piece, for, you know, from an attorney's point of view, you must see and hear so very, very, very many things. And I've talked to people as a journalist that are telling me their stories. And then I'm excited to also interview some therapists who can explain this and help us unpack it further.
Often people will come to me and they are thinking about leaving their spouse. It could be the guy. It could be the guy who is in control of the majority of the financial assets. It could be the woman who's in charge of the majority of the financial assets. It could be a woman who is earning less than her spouse but feels she needs to protect herself. It could be a guy making a lot of money who also feels he needs to protect himself. And sometimes someone will come to me for what's called divorce planning, where they're saying, my spouse has no idea, but I want to get all my ducks in a row, and I want to leave them. How should I do that? And, you know, there's the whole nuclear option. Let's say someone is being abused. Is it permissible to back up a truck when your spouse is out of town, empty out the house, put the kids in the car, drive across country and go settle somewhere else and not even tell your spouse where you are, or perhaps tell them once you're all settled in there? Is that appropriate? Is it, quote, legal? Maybe, and yeah. You know, but the first question is the more important one, is that appropriate? And there are some times where that might be the appropriate thing. Other people will say, hey, we have this bank account, and it's got all this money in there, and it's joint. Can I take all that and put it in my separate name? And the legal answer to that might very well be, yeah, sure you can. You can do all that. But the more appropriate question might be, is that the appropriate course of action? Is that going to make things worse down the road? Or is that necessary for your protection, and should you do that? Maybe. So there are very real and significant actions that people can take if they're the one who wants out. And although some of these actions may be perfectly legal, they may not be the best solution to try to resolve things for a long-term resolution.
Gosh, what you deal with is mind-boggling. I can't imagine, and I give you a lot of credit, because those are some seriously trying situations. So, you know, these five powerful stages that people experience. They're similar, obviously, to the stages of grief, because it is a letting go, a loss. So
Absolutely.
Stage one is probably a favorite of many people, the denial and avoidance stage. So what happens in this one?
Well, I would say most of the clients who come to see me, and I've been working in family law at this point for over 29 years, and I see hundreds of people each year. I've worked with thousands of people. And I would say the vast overwhelming majority of them have been unhappy for about at least 2 years, where they're telling themselves, it's not that bad, it'll get better, it's okay, they don't mean it, it'll change, it'll be okay if this happens or when that happens. And occasionally there might even be very clear signs that their spouse has already checked out, but for whatever reason, somebody in denial doesn't want to acknowledge that their marriage is ending, and they literally put their head in the sand and just don't want to think about what it would be like to live without their spouse. And it isn't necessarily because they love their spouse. It might be because they haven't been out in the workforce and they're nervous about getting back out into the workforce, or they like the lifestyle or the social status, or, you know, everything's just organized very nicely in their life, and although they may not be in love with their spouse or feel their spouse loves them, they still might not want to end the marriage for other reasons. Or it can just be fear. How am I going to make it on my own? So somebody in denial just, you know, the signs are right there in front of them, but they just don't want to look reality in the eye, and they're going to ignore it and deny it.
Yeah, I can see where that would be comforting to a certain level, not practical, but comforting. And then stage two, you know, I think it's, you know, obviously very much attached to denial and avoidance, which is the bargaining. Talk a little bit about
that. Let's go to counseling, or if I get into recovery, or if we, you know, if I get back out into the workforce and start contributing to the household expenses, or we try having date nights, or we do this other thing, you know, maybe we can put a spark back in our marriage. It's not a bad thing, but often marriage counseling sort of solidifies the fact that people really aren't happy together. There is like a marriage recovery movement out there. I don't see the people who get in a tough spot and then work through it. I see the people who got in a tough spot and decided they're going to go separate ways. So there might very well be a large percentage of people out there. You know, I was listening to a TED Talk the other day about a lady who studies infidelity, and she likened infidelity to a cancer, where there are times when someone who is faced with a life-threatening illness all of a sudden realizes what's important, and they get a new look and a new lease on life, and they become more appreciative. And she talks about, in her therapeutic practice, there are people who, kind of like that old Barry Manilow song about the pina coladas and walking on the beaches, and, you know, remember that somebody places a personal ad, and then their spouse answers it, and they're like, oh, I didn't know you liked all those things. So there are actually people who might start a real discussion after an affair as to what was missing. Why did that person capture your attention? What did you feel when you were with them? What did you feel when you came home to me? What is missing? What do you need? And the people that have those questions, not was he or she better than me and how many times were you together and were you in our bed, but the people who actually look at why the affair occurred, I don't see those people getting a divorce, because those people might actually work through the reasons someone strayed, and they make their marriage stronger. Now, that's rather controversial, but it kind of blew my mind a little bit when I heard that on the TED Talk that this lady gave. Bargaining, generally, in my book, as I talk about it, is the second stage of the process. Someone will very briefly, after denial, say, well, what if we do this, and what if we do that, and maybe we can do this, and maybe we can do that, and that is often the second stage when the marriage is going to end.
I love the recovery thought, you know, because just a lot of people can't go there. I think it's because a lot of people don't want to look at themselves, you know, for a million different reasons.
If I can just touch on that, you know, when someone is abusive or has a substance abuse problem and they're angry is pain. Anger doesn't just happen. It usually happens because of pain. And often it's pain from childhood experiences. And unless someone really wants to explore why are they hurting, why is that 6-7-year-old child still inside them telling themselves, it doesn't matter, it doesn't hurt, I don't care, it's all right, and they're shutting off that part of themselves, unless someone is willing to go back in time and really explore the source of their pain that's creating their anger, they're not going to overcome it. And I've found, just anecdotally, that when people do that important work towards their personal growth, and let me diverge again, divorce can be a jumping off point for personal growth, like any conflict. It's going to bring out the best in someone or the worst in someone. And a person who wants to explore, why is this marriage failing? Why am I so unhappy? I want to understand that and work on that and work on myself. Those people who do that might find that the divorce is what they need and it's extremely liberating, or they may feel they have to take on their demons finally and their spouse might actually be supportive and help them do that. But I've found anecdotally that if they don't do that by the time they're about 50, they never will, because they've just been stuck in that pattern for so many decades. But people in their 30s and 40s sometimes are willing to take a real hard look at, why am I so angry and unhappy? Why am I losing my spouse? Why am I involved in this sex addiction? Why am I doing this? I love my spouse and kids and life and family. Why am I doing this destructive thing? And they might even have a supportive spouse who stands by them and helps them on that path.
Absolutely. And that's the goal, right? And to me, like, that's what marriage is. It's two people that come together and they work their way through things. But I think the caveat there is that both people have to be willing to look at it. Another one of our experts is Dr. Eleanor Greenberg, who wrote about narcissism, borderline, and schizoid personality disorders, and how that's really making a huge impact on, you know, relationships. People get into relationships with each other who have these things that happen as children that they're not looking at. And so they build up, like you're just saying, you know, they build up these defense mechanisms which protect them, or they think they protect them, and then they're in a marriage and suddenly they can't run and hide, so they choose divorce. But in my observation of talking to so many people for my case studies for the book, they just keep repeating those patterns. And so what Dr. Greenberg is talking about is, how do you address them, how do you identify them before you get into a relationship? Because, you know, someone who's attracted to a schizoid personality, not schizophrenia but a schizoid personality, you know, that's a catch and release thing as opposed to a narcissist. And so it just sort of takes, it absolutely takes what you're saying and goes into that psychology of it.
In many, many cases where one of the parties has borderline personality disorder or borderline narcissistic personality disorder, and in those particular cases, it's important to understand that these behavior traits are not something you fix with a pill. And someone who has that type of personality is very, very unlikely to ever, ever, ever change. And it's all about setting limits and modeling how to set limits for the children. You know, if somebody says, oh my gosh, my husband was yelling at me and swearing at me on the phone for half an hour, calling me names in front of my child, my first question to her is going to be, why did you stand and listen for half an hour instead of immediately hang up the phone and say, I will not be talked to like that, click, so that you're modeling that sort of behavior for your child instead of feeling like you somehow have to put up with that. And someone who is narcissistic or has borderline personality disorder can be extraordinarily charming. They're manipulative. Everybody loves them, but they have this other side that people don't see, and people feel like, you know, no one will see, especially if they're being, as they say, gaslighted and being told that they're the crazy one, even though their spouse is manipulating them and controlling them. That's a minority, I think, of the marriage breakups that I see, maybe 1 to 3% of the time. There's that extreme sort of negativity. And in that case, it's a perfect example for the party who's leaving the borderline narcissist to learn to stand up for yourself, to learn how to set limits, to teach your children how to set limits, because, again, divorce, like any conflict, will bring out the best in you or the worst in you. And you can lower yourself to your spouse's level and say it's all about getting even and being vindictive and convincing everybody that you're right and the other person's wrong and you're better than the other person and all this, Or you can hold your head up and say, I'm going to move forward, I'm going to create a new life, I'm going to set boundaries and limits with you, and I don't hear you, you know. It's a process of growth.
Isn't everything. So talk a little bit about stage three, that grief, fear, shock, confusion, turmoil. And again, bring in that thing, you know, because I think this is so important. A lot of people that I've interviewed have said they stayed in their marriages where they were unhappy for their children. And my counsel to them is always, you know, but that's what you're teaching them. Right?
Right. And you know what? I see this equally with men and with women. I have represented men who told me it's been 20 years and I've been unhappy for about 18 of them. And here's how the marriage started. But you know what? I'm the one that cooks and cleans and does the laundry and works full time and takes the kids to their activities and does all this. And we haven't been intimate in 6, 7, 8, 10 years. But, you know, if I left the kids with her, none of this would get done because she has issues or gets up at 10 every morning and won't work and this, that, and the other. And then there are women who say, he's been abusive, he doesn't pay attention to me, I think he has Asperger's, there's no emotion behind anything, and it's empty and sad, but I want to stay together, quote, for the sake of the kids. And I've been very strong in telling people, you know, well, what are you teaching your kids? You're teaching them to stay for money. Is that what you're doing? Are you teaching them that the status of saying we're an intact family and, you know, just a good family is important? Is it important to have the income so your kids can have activities? And there are perfectly miserable kids that just wonder why their parents are staying together because there's so much conflict. And those kids are going to have a much tougher time than if their parents divorced and they lived in a one-bedroom apartment that was calm and had love in it, than if they're staying in the nice, you know, country club house with all the amenities, listening to fighting and arguing and dysfunction every day. So it's very important if there's a lot of negativity to understand that if you're, you know, in a marriage because you feel you should be there for the sake of the kids, you may not be doing your children any favors at all. You're teaching them what a dysfunctional marriage is all about, and they're telling themselves, it doesn't matter, it doesn't hurt, I don't feel anything, it's okay, I know my parent isn't there for me. And guess what? When they get married, they've already shut off that part of themselves, they've shut off their heart, and they can't emotionally connect with their spouse, and it perpetuates. You know, often you'll find that the abusive person with mental health or substance abuse issues or the borderline narcissist was in a family where the mom and dad were fighting all the time or somebody had an issue and their needs weren't being met. So they told themselves, I don't feel it, I don't care, it's all right. Or they grow up feeling that they have to get their needs met at all costs and at the expense of anybody else's needs. And that's what you're doing to your kids if you stay in a marriage that's really, really bad. You need to get out. And I can't tell you how many times people have left the really nice, expensive, big home to get into a smaller apartment, and then they tell me, oh my gosh, I wake up in the morning and that negativity is gone. I wake up happy. I'm relaxed. I'm not walking on eggshells. It used to be the air was so thick you could cut it with a knife, and now it's just so much different and the kids are happier. And they are. If the marriage is that painful, it will be a 2-year process of getting your finances together, getting your income up, getting through the court process, but you're going to be doing your kids a better favor in a lot of cases, but not in every case, because unfortunately I've also had a lot of cases where somebody says, you know what, I hung in there for 20 years and my kids are graduates of this, that, and the other Ivy League school, and this one's a doctor and that one's in the military and this one's doing great, and you know what, I'm 52 years old now and now it's my time and I'm done and the kids got raised up and I hung in there at my expense with a spouse, maybe a wife, maybe a husband who was not intimate with me for 10 years, and now I'm on, you know, some dating site and I'm ready to go. And in those cases, it really shocked me because it made me think, if there isn't conflict, although the kids see there isn't love and affection, but maybe they understand, I don't know, is it the right thing to stay? And these are the questions that you really have to work on with a mental health professional. It might be the right thing to stay. Maybe there is no right or wrong, but certainly when there's abuse, I think it's wrong to stay. You're teaching your kids that. You're putting them at risk. When there's a lot of conflict, I think it's wrong to stay because it's hurting the kids and it's going to put them at risk. But, you know, I kind of wonder with some of these sort of empty, loveless marriages of convenience where they're great parents and they love their kids, you know, I don't know. That's a harder question to answer about whether you should stay together for the sake of the kids. That's a really tough one there.
I totally agree. And, you know, that's why I came up with these five different reasons that are in my mind, you know, the ones where they're obviously being harmed. You're doing the harm or you're being harmed or there's harm going on, physical, mental, emotional, you know, abuse, addiction, adultery, those scarlet letters.
The person doing the harm, if I can interrupt, usually won't acknowledge that they're doing the harm. I just want to put that out there. Those are usually people who refuse to see it and accept the blame, usually.
Well, right. And, like, I keep trying to mine down into what's under all of this, this lack of self-love, right? That was the message that I tried to share at the luncheon and when I speak about the book, because when you love yourself, you don't allow yourself to get into these situations. And that communication piece where you meet somebody and you pretty much see them clearly, but something's missing in your ability to say, but it's probably not going to be good in the long run. There are things there that I'm seeing as red flags, and so many people ignore them. I've talked to so many people who've gotten divorced. They're like, I knew the day I got married I shouldn't be doing this, but I didn't have the guts to say no at that point. And, you know, and I think, as to your point, a lot of people just don't want to work on their own stuff for whatever reason. And I'm glad to hear it's only a small percentage.
Yeah, I think the really extreme cases, at least the ones I have, are, you know, 97% of civil suits and divorce suits settle. That means only 3% are fully litigated. About half of my cases are very amicably resolved. You almost wonder why they're getting a divorce. They're so kind to each other. There's real tenderness. Even if there's been adultery and other pain, there's such dignity in about half of the time. 25% of the time, you know, people are going to horse trade and see how far they can push, but they know they're not going to go to court, and they're going to resolve things amicably through a settlement. It's maybe 25% that starts to fight in court, and most of them ultimately at some point will get it resolved. And it's that 3% that there's usually borderline narcissism or substance abuse or some other dysfunction. But back to an earlier point you were talking about when you first meet someone and whether there were warning signs. You know, people might get married and there are no warning signs and it's perfect and it's lovely and it's great and it's wonderful. But you are not the same person at 50 or 40 or 30 that you were at 25. You're a different person. You're not the same person you were at 16 and 10. Everybody changes. And it's really a question of whether in a marriage, especially a long-term marriage, people are going to change together or go off in different directions, whether they're supportive. People will move, have career changes. There will be losses of jobs. There might be the death of a child. I've had that happen in many occasions in my cases. I've seen that. There may be criminal charges that come up. There are family issues that come up. All kinds of difficulties arise, but even when there are not difficulties, there's joy. People still grow. People change from 25 to 50. And although many, many years back, a lot of people did not divorce after staying together for 20 years because in the 50s and 60s and 70s, you know, life was different. Nowadays, a lot of people feel they can start a new chapter at age 50 or age 55, and a lot of people do. And the reason they are is because they feel that they can't have that new chapter with their spouse. You know, if your kids have just left home and there you are, you're done being parents, and all that time you spent running around with your kids and doing stuff with them is gone, and now you're looking at your spouse like, okay, now what? It's a whole new chapter. It's a whole new time, which could be approached with a sense of awe and wonder and, hey, what are we going to do now with this phase of our life? Or someone might say, hey, I'm out of here. I want to go do something different. So even though there may not be warning signs when you meet, you're just not the same person at 50, 40 that you were at 30 and 20.
Personal growth and growing together, it's I mean, they say it's work, but it's sometimes it's impossible, I think. And again, I keep going back to what's under all of this, and that's knowing yourself, loving yourself, and being with somebody that does the same so you can communicate and get through it. You know, this part of this trilogy, as you mentioned, is Why Divorce, Why Marry, Why Remarry, Five Reasons to Leave, Five Reasons to Say Yes, and Five Reasons to Do It Again. And I love telling these love stories because the divorce is still full of love stories. But the people who stay together, you know, I'm fascinated by how they've done that.
I was thinking, Hope, you really need to have a fourth book, which is Why Stay, or How Do You Stay? And you were just starting to talk about that, because really what you're talking about is what is it that people do to work together over a 20, 30, 40-year marriage that works for them? Because, of course, there are hardships. Is it the respect they show each other? Is it the support? Is it the acceptance? Is it giving the other party freedom to do things? So that's the fourth book, is why do people stay? How do they stay, you know?
That definitely makes sense. In fact, when I was giving that speech, a woman came up to me after, because in the beginning, you know, I explained the five reasons, and then I asked, you know, who's divorced, who's thinking about getting divorced, you don't need to raise your hand, and, you know, who, divorce is not even in your vocabulary, you can happily marry forever. And she came up to me afterward, and she said, you didn't ask how many of us are separated, and separated for a really long time.
How many of you have thought about divorce? How many of you got to the brink where you were really considering it, and then didn't, and it worked out? Why? How? And I think you'll find that in almost every marriage, people get to a point at times where their needs aren't being met, and they start thinking, am I going to be happier without this person? And what is it that they did that made them realize, no, I'm going to be happier staying, but this is what we're going to do to make it better? Staying together.
Right.
So many people get to the brink, but then realize, no, it's not to be thrown away. And what is it that those people are doing?
I was just having a conversation before we jumped on this interview call with a friend of mine who was deep in that question when I met her like 8 years ago, and she was having an affair, and her husband found out, and they worked their way through it. And, you know, she talks about that and how, you know, they just decided this was the right thing. There's still a brokenness, she was articulating, because she knows that he looks at her sometimes and feels that betrayal. But yet they now have a stronger marriage, to your earlier point, that sometimes, you know, it can make you better, like that, you know, having a terminal disease and surviving it.
But having a sex addiction, which is a different sort of thing, that's somebody who, like engaging in any addictive behavior, has some pain that they're trying to fill with dysfunction, whether it's food, drink, alcohol, shopping, gambling, spending, you know. That's different than the reasons why a person reaches out to another person and has this one affair kind of thing. But I think you were also talking about, you know, these stages that I think when someone is being left, that they go through when they're heading towards a divorce. And first, of course, there's the denial, and then there's the bargaining. And I think we were just starting to talk about the grief, shock, fear, confusion, turmoil. Did we get to that yet? Often people come to me and they just found the cell phone records, or they just realize that life is not good and they're going to be happier perhaps without their spouse, but they're not sure. And I go through boxes of tissues each year. You know, when people come to see me, often they're at the lowest point, and they're scared. They don't know what it would look like to be on their own. Maybe they haven't been working outside the home. They've been a homemaker. Maybe they've been out of the job market for 5 or 10 years or so. They have a certain lifestyle, and they're thinking, how do I tell the kids? How do I tell everyone else? What am I going to do? What about money? And that's on both sides. You know, the guy might be, what about money? How am I going to afford two households? And is she going to take the kids away from me? You know, there's a lot of fear on both sides. And it's important when someone is in the throes of all that fear to realize that they have a measure of control. They can make a plan. They can work towards that plan. And we need to get those emotions sorted out. And if someone is really struggling and they can't function, they're crying all the time, they just can't sleep, they can't work, then short-term medication is a good thing. Some people would say, oh, they'll use it against me in court and say that I saw a therapist and I'm on some kind of antidepressant. No, a judge is going to applaud you for taking care of your mental health. We take care of our physical health. We need to take care of our emotional and mental health and do what has to be done. And it's important to take care of yourself in this process. You know, some people feel, well, I've got to be very strong for the kids and I've got to do this and I've got to do that. Well, some of what you have to do is take care of yourself. Reach out for support, reach out to friends, family, and get informed. See a good attorney, get some good advice, not from your, you know, friends, family, hairdresser, mechanic, golf club buddies, whatever. See an experienced, seasoned litigator who has an idea of what judges do and what they don't do, whether what you want is realistic. I can't tell you how many women come to me, they're scared, and they say, well, you know, I need so much per month, and I don't want to work because that'll hurt my alimony case because I need $10,000 a month. And, you know, chances of you getting $10,000 a month may not be super great. And even if you did, you're not working towards maybe a 20-year career where you could put some retirement away and whatnot, because the spousal support you might get is nowhere near sufficient to live the way you want to live, and you're kind of hurting yourself perhaps by not getting out there into the job market. So people are scared and confused, and they're not getting good advice. And in that crazy, crazy period, sometimes they're saying, but I don't want the divorce. And, you know, it might be important to realize, but you're going to get one because your spouse is going to leave you, and it's happening. So here's what we have to do to take care of you and for you to take care of yourself. So that's a really tough stage for men and women who really are petrified, afraid of losing so much.
And I think that's why a lot of people don't do it, or they push it off until it just sorts itself out in some way where they have the courage to take this giant step, because it does suck. I mean, there's no way about it.
They might hurt themselves by waiting too long, you know, and if their spouse gave them a proposed agreement and they throw it in the trash and don't want to look at it, their spouse or their ex-to-be is going to get more and more angry and less generous. And meanwhile, they're making plans, but you're not. And it's important to get out of what's probably the denial phase. And people go back and forth through all these phases, or are in some of them simultaneously, you know, denial and grief, shock, fear, confusion. And that's not a good place to be if your spouse is getting all their, you know, ducks in a row.
That was actually a question that I had. Do these phases in your observation go in a linear manner, or are they like all like souped together, or is it?
Not only are they back and forth and grouped together, but you and your ex-to-be might be in different phases at different times. And if your spouse is at acceptance and you're at denial, or your spouse is in anger and you're at acceptance, that is very determinative of whether your case will be worked out the easy way or the hard way. And when people come to me, the first thing that we have to figure out is, do we need to stand up and fight, or can we sit down and work it out? Do we need to stand up and fight and go to court and get involved in litigation because you need to protect yourself from harm and abuse? Or can we sit down and mediate or collaborate or engage in an amicable negotiation, maybe a four-way, maybe a collaborative case? Because it's not about grabbing all the marbles. We want to just try to create a new two-home family, create a new life plan, and just work together with respect and cooperation. So in this crazy, confused stage, it's important to sort out, can you meaningfully participate perhaps in a mediation where you and your spouse talk with a neutral mediator, but you have to be able to speak up and talk? Or do you need somebody by your side who will talk for you, who will advocate for you and advise you, maybe in a collaborative kind of a case or a non-adversarial negotiation? Because you don't have the financial ability or the mental health ability to fight it out in court. You know, it might be that working it out is better because you aren't up for the fight. But if your spouse is not going to be generous and they think you'll just take whatever they hand you, well, then maybe we have to rattle the saber and make it clear that we will fight one way or another, because they have to believe that you'll fight and you have to be ready to fight in order to get the best settled resolution, or you may just have to go out and go to court. So in that stage of confusion, it's important to sort out, can we all sit down and work it out? And if you're in denial, then, you know, maybe you need to kind of move out of denial, or do you need to take some serious action to protect yourself and go to court?
Yeah, and those are the four ways that you talk about: litigation, negotiation, collaboration, and mediation. And, you know, step five is that you finally get to acceptance. But
well, you skip through the anger.
Yeah, right. Well,
anger is a big part of it. I would say that most of the time when there's a lot of litigation, it's because somebody is angry. Angry, controlling, fearful, greedy. You know, the anger is what fuels litigation, because it's not rational to spend tens and tens and tens of thousands of dollars fighting it out in court, putting on a show for a judge. It's an old-fashioned way to resolve a family dispute. It is two lawyers putting on a show. The judge sees a little snapshot in time. And I will say that there are very, very few reasons to litigate a case. You know, if somebody wants to relocate with a child, even that should be worked out, but that's one of the harder things to work out, and often those cases go to litigation. But when you're talking about 90% of marriages where there's maybe a house and some retirement and child support, custody, and maybe some spousal support, there is no reason that can't get worked out through what are called alternative dispute resolution methods, as opposed to litigation. I would like to think, however, that someday the alternative dispute resolution methods would be the accepted methods and that litigation is the alternative. But in my experience, the people who litigate, one of them is stuck in anger or control. And if you want to work things out but your spouse is angry, it might be that you're not going to work it out. And when people come to see me, I care about these five stages, and I want to know what kind of stage each of them are in. I'll ask questions like, are you both able to talk? Do you communicate well? And what I'm really doing is fishing for an understanding of whether somebody's in anger or not, because if they are, I know that it's not going to be easy. But if they're both in acceptance, then that's when we might start talking about, well, maybe we want to mediate this. Maybe we can do it amicably through collaboration or negotiation. You know, let's try to stay out of court. And then if both people are at acceptance, they're much, much more likely to resolve things less expensively.
Yeah, and that seems like the goal. So you're talking about implementing a plan and to get your life back. So what are the steps to do that?
Well, there's two plans. You know, after understanding denial, bargaining, grief, anger, acceptance comes get informed. You know, what are your rights? What are your responsibilities? What are your spouse's rights and responsibilities? And it's important to understand whether or not what you're hoping for is at all realistic. And then after getting informed comes make a plan, and there are actually two types of plans. The first make a plan is, how do we want to resolve this? Litigate, negotiate, collaborate, or mediate? Do we need to stand up and fight it out, or can we sit down and work it out? And then the next make a plan is, where do I want to be 1 year, 2 years, 5 years, 10 years from now? Because you're not going to get there unless you know exactly where you are going. And the one-year plan might be a kind of a temporary, I need to get out of the house, I might have to put my stuff in storage, I need to take some classes, brush off my resume, I need to find, you know, maybe a rental for a year while I get things sorted out and get through this whole legal process. The two-year plan might be to get more settled. I found that most people seem to take about 2 years to get through the divorce. They might have to live apart for a year before they can even file, and if it's going to be difficult, it might take 6 months or more to actually get through that process. So it can be a two-year process. The good news about that is there is an end to it, but the bad news is, yeah, it can take about 2 years. And then we need to think about what's the 5-year plan and what's the 10-year plan. The 5-year plan might be, let me get back into the workforce, let's do this with the kids. The 10-year plan might be, where do I ultimately want to wind up? So the first make a plan is, do we want to litigate, negotiate, collaborate, or mediate? Can you and your ex-to-be work this out amicably, creating a new two-home family? Or do you need to fight it out, and that's going to be more expensive and more time-consuming? And then the other make a plan again is, where do I want to be 1 year, 2 years, 5 years, 10 years from now? Do we want to try to live right near each other and share custody, where maybe mom has the kids Monday night and Tuesday night, and dad has the kids Wednesday night, Thursday night, and they alternate Friday through Monday night, which is 50-50, and maybe tweak it a little bit where a young child might spend 5 hours on Sunday with the other person, or maybe there's a boy and a girl, and the first week of each month on her Tuesday and his Wednesday, they each only have one child. So there's daddy-daughter time, daddy-son time, mommy-daughter time, mommy-son time. So we can tweak that, you know, or if people don't want to co-parent or can't co-parent or don't want to live right near each other, it may not be practical to share 50-50 custody. And that's going to really depend upon whether people are committed to living in the same school district or a short drive outside the school district, which they will make. Or is one person saying, no, I travel a lot for my job, I do shift work, and, you know, I don't want to fight for half custody. And, you know, that might be a woman who says that. And there was always a big stigma early on for a woman to say, you know, I'm working hard in my career, I work 80 hours a week, and he's been more of the running around, taking the kids here and there and keeping the, you know, the household going. And there was a time if a woman said, I want to let him have primary custody, she was vilified. But I think in Northern Virginia, more women earn more than their husbands in this particular part of the country. So a lot of women have a business, a professional practice, and, you know, they're trying to do it all and trying to be a mom, and often that is absolutely accomplished. But very frequently, people might say, you know, it works for both of us to share these kids exactly equally, and that Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, alternate Friday to Monday arrangement is one of the best ways to do that.
So many options. And, you know, so the plan and then sticking to it, that's what's crucial, knowing what you want and what you agree to and then keeping on path. Is that hard for a lot of people to do?
Well, you might have a plan, but your spouse might have a different plan, you know, and then you might have to change your plan. So there's a bit of flexibility, but it's important to have an inner sense of what's right and what's wrong and what you're fighting for, what you're working towards, and you have to believe in yourself. You know, I had a picture that I got in the 80s. It was taken of a kayaker in the middle of all this crazy rapids, and their head is down, and they're holding the paddle very purposefully. And all around them, the photo was taken on like a, I don't know what you call it, like a slow exposure or something. So all the water is just in this picture swirling around the person, but they look so focused, like they know where they're going, even though there's craziness all around them. I have people who come from other countries, and they say, let's say it's a lady, you know, my husband expects me to cook, clean, serve him, feed him, do the laundry, do everything else, take care of the kids, and I work the same exact job he works, because in our country, that's how it's been. But you know what? And throw in a little bit of abuse, I'm tired of it. I don't want to be married anymore to this person. But my family back home will disown me because I'm going to dishonor our family. It's going to be harder for my sisters to get married because they now know that they're in a family where someone might leave their spouse. I have had people tell me, if I divorce this person, I'm ending my relationship with my family. And that's a hard decision to make. But, yeah, I've had people make that decision. I had a guy come to me once who, you know, said this particular person wasn't who I thought they would be, but I know that the person that I want to be with, who's of a different religion, will not be accepted by my family, and I'm going to be done with my family. They'll have nothing to do with me, but I can't spend the next 50, 60 years unhappy, and I'm going to move on. So I forget what exact question prompted this particular answer, but, you know, life brings a lot of challenges, a lot of difficulty, and you have to have an inner compass of what your plan is and what you feel is the right thing. And there sometimes there isn't a right and a wrong, and sometimes there is a right and a wrong. But there can be huge repercussions often for people who have family, quote, back home, and how the divorce is even going to impact them. I have divorces where the whole family seems to come to the initial meeting. I got mom and dad and sister and brother, and then my client, and I have to make it crystal clear, client is making the decisions. But in some cases, it's actually two families that are divorcing. It's not just the two parties. But as an attorney, and this is a separate sort of little side issue, you know, I can't be as concerned about the wishes of everybody else there unless it's exactly what my client wants. And if they're sitting there with downcast eyes, not saying anything, I've got to clear that room out and get that person alone and say, you know, what is it that you want to do here?
Wow. Well, we're hitting the hour mark, but there is so much more to talk about. I would love for you to come back on so we can keep addressing it.
It's not like you can look at divorce and make a nice little handbook of here's how you do it and here's all the answers, because every single case is so unique. You can't even think about how many different pigeonholes there are. You know, as when we first started off and you said, well, what if you're the one who wants out? You know, people might assume, oh, you want out because your spouse is bad. Well, maybe they're not, and maybe you're bad. And, you know, you just can't say there's this formula and category for everything with a neat, clear answer, because everybody's different, their situation is different, and, you know, it's important to find counsel and friends and therapists who can help you focus on how to move forward.
And that's exactly what you've done in your book, the 200-page guidebook, which has things to fill in, and just it's wonderful. I really encourage people to pick up The 4 Ways of Divorce, available on Amazon. And Rachel is also one of our truly amazing women. As we launch Incandescent Women magazine, next week you'll be able to find her there, and also on whydivorce.us, my book. You are listening to the Why Divorce podcast on the Incandescent Radio Network. I am here with Rachel Virk, attorney at law, divorce attorney in Northern Virginia. So thank you again for your time, and I really look forward to bringing you back on the show.
Well, thank you, Hope. It's been a lot of fun, and I hope that some of the information can be of help to people who are in this incredibly important stage of their life.
Absolutely, and we'll definitely bring you back on, because your book is full of just wonderful things, so I'd like to address the different topics over the course of this project. And thank you to our audience for listening to the Why Divorce podcast on the Incandescent Radio Network. I'm Hope Katz Gibbs. We hope that you aren't going through a divorce, but if you are, we hope that we are guiding you in a good way where you can have that positive outcome without too much angst. So we'll talk to you soon. Have a great day.
Thank you so much for listening to today's episode of Why Divorce. If you or anyone you know and love would like to be interviewed for the show, please let us know. We're also looking for people to share their stories as case studies, and they can remain anonymous, and for experts to help guide our audience through this important process. Just email me at hope@hopegibbs.com. That's hope@hopegibbs.com. Until we talk again, wishing you joy and peace.